Could we turn, please, to 2 Samuel chapter 12? This is our final study in our series on the books of Samuel and Psalms. And tonight we're concerned with David's family troubles, and it all started over his sin with Bathsheba. We're all familiar with it. How, first of all, he committed adultery. He was guilty of sexual immorality. He was also guilty of murder because he engineered the death of Uriah, his wife he had taken. Whereupon, God's prophet Nathan brought God's judgment, or announced God's judgment, upon David in 2 Samuel 12, verse 10. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house. You've been guilty of murder. You're going to find that you'll have the same problems within your own house from here on, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbour, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. And it's not long, as you read in the story, it's not long before we find things starting to turn against David. And if he acted in a certain way as father of the family, it's not to be wondered that the children ran off and did the same sorts of things. David had a son called Amnon. He was the oldest of David's sons. He also had a daughter called Tamar by a different wife. Amnon raped Tamar. Tamar had a brother, Absalom, a full brother. And Absalom sought to avenge the indignity which his sister had suffered. And we find that what happened was that Absalom waited patiently for the opportunity to get Amnon. In chapter 13, verse 19, you find Tamar's disgrace referred to. She put ashes on her head, rent her long robe which she wore, and she went around crying and weeping over her ill-fated experience with her brother. Verse 23 tells us that Absalom waited 2 years. He was a cool customer, was Absalom. He was in no hurry, but he was determined to get his revenge. And after 2 years, we find he worked the opportunity to get Amnon away from the palace, and there he used some of his men to kill Amnon. Now this whole sort of story, if you follow it through, takes exactly the same course as David's own sin. Sexual immorality, followed by murder, with the murderer very carefully plotting how to get rid of the victim, but making sure that he himself did not do the dirty deed, getting somebody else to do him for it. Exactly the same pattern, you might say, as David had done, so had Absalom. When Absalom had committed this murder, in verse 37 we find that he fled and went to Talmai, the son of somebody, king of Geshur. Now Talmai was the mother, or the father, of Absalom's mother. That is, Absalom's mother, whom David had married, was a daughter of this king of Geshur. So Absalom fled there, knowing that he could find refuge in his mother's home. And in verse 38, we are told that he stayed there 3 years. This meant that the royal family was suddenly depleted rather drastically. First of all, you have the eldest son, Amnon, murdered. The second son, Kileab, seems to have died. The third son, Absalom, has now fled into exile. And you might say then that the dynasty is a little shaky. David's chief henchman was a man called Joab. And it appears that Joab wanted to see some sort of stability restored to the nation, and he wanted to see an heir firmly recognized. And that heir he judged to be Absalom. But Absalom was away wasting in exile. Therefore, Joab engineered a situation to try to get Absalom back. He got a woman to go to the king with a story, a hypothetical story, and the long and the short of it is that this woman put to the king the proposition that although a person may have committed murder and have been guilty of a capital offence and deserve the death penalty carried out upon him, yet for certain humanitarian or compassionate reasons the sentence may be waived and the person may be allowed to live. When the proposition was put to David, David said, yes, I think that that would be a reasonable case for us to be lenient and not to carry out the death sentence. Whereupon the woman said, you are the man. You won't even let Absalom come back, and you should receive him back. And as soon as David heard the lady say this, he said to her, has Joab been talking to you? And of course the woman said, my lord, the king knows everything. Obviously Joab had been putting the same idea to David, and David had been resisting, because David knew that if Absalom came back he would have to carry out justice. But now he himself had given a judgment to say that it was okay for the king to allow such a person back in certain circumstances. The woman said, these are the circumstances. David said, okay, I surrender. And he then allowed Absalom to return. And in chapter 14 verse 21, after this episode is completed, the king said to Joab, behold, now I grant this, go bring back the young man Absalom. Whereupon Joab brought Absalom back. But in verse 23, after he had brought Absalom to Jerusalem, in verse 24 the king said, but let him dwell apart in his own house, he is not to come into my presence. So Absalom dwelt apart in his own house and did not come into the king's presence. The king was letting it be known that he didn't want Absalom as heir, that Absalom was still not a fit person, and so there was still this estrangement. Even though he was back in the country, he still did not come before the king or enter the palace. But Absalom just bided his time. He was an ambitious man, and he obviously had his eye on the top spot. He was cold and calculating and ruthless. And for the next 2 years, he bided his time and built himself up a firm base from which to work. And at the end of 2 years, he said to Joab, now engineer a situation so that I can get in and speak to the king. Joab, during these 2 years, had no doubt come to realize that he had opened Pandora's box. And in getting Absalom back, he had bought himself a whole heap of trouble. And Joab was in no hurry whatever to get Absalom into the king's presence, because he could see now that maybe Absalom would be quite a tough proposition. When he was a bit tardy in going and seeing the king, Absalom showed him that he meant business by going and burning Joab's fields, whereupon Joab almost broke his leg then getting to the palace to arrange this interview with the king. You find it referred to verse 28. Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence, and after the episode of the burning of the fields in verse 33, Joab went to the king and told him, and the king summoned Absalom, so he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. The reconciliation is now complete. Absalom is back in royal favour. It's like the Pope kissing the Archbishop of Canterbury or something like that. A rift is healed by this public demonstration of reconciliation. Once Absalom is back in the royal favour, he doesn't waste any time now in establishing his position. As heir to the throne, in verse 1 of chapter 15, he got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. But he was also very cunning. He used to rise up early in the morning and go and stand by way of the gate. Now the gate was the area around the city wall where people used to meet to talk about things and to have their problems listened to by the rulers. Any disputes were decided here in the gate of the city. And when people would come from the country areas, Absalom would come to these people and say, in verse 2, we'll read verse 2, Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate, and when any man had a suit to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, from what city are you? Country people, you see, coming to Jerusalem. And when he said, your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel, Absalom would say to him, see, your claims are good and right, but there is no man deputed by the king to hear you. What he's saying is, yes, I'm on your side, yes, you've got a good case there, and of course, if I was giving the judgment, well, I'd be all for you. but you know, the bureaucracy here is so bad, there's red tape tying up everything, and you have to wait a long time, and the poor old king, you know, the whole place is going to the pack. Now this was the sort of thing that was going on. Absalom was ingratiating himself with the people, winning the people over onto his side, and at the same time pointing the finger at the bureaucratic red tape which his father David was responsible for. And in this way, Absalom was slowly but surely winning the hearts of some of the country people. And this went on in verse 7, we are told, for 4 years. And just put these years together. There were the 2 years he waited to murder Amnon, another 3 years in exile, back again waiting another 2 more years before he went into the king's presence, another 4 years. We're up to 11 years. This is the man who has his ambition set, and nothing is going to turn him aside. And he's cruel, and he's determined to get his own vain way. And at the end of 4 years, he made the excuse that he wanted to go to Hebron, which was in the south of the land, for some sort of religious festival. And you know the outcome was that when he got there, he collected around him these people that he had ingratiated himself with, and then they launched a rebellion. The whole thing took David by surprise, because David still had a good following in Jerusalem. David didn't want civil war in his land, and he certainly didn't want Jerusalem flowing with blood. So what he did was simply to clear out. He thought that was the wisest thing to do, to take his main body of fighting men with him and to get out of Jerusalem so that he had a chance to reorganize himself and just leave Absalom to do what he wished. In a way, you might say it was very noble of David in that he wanted to save Jerusalem from unnecessary bloodshed, and he certainly didn't want a civil war right in the middle of the city. So in verse 14 of chapter 15, David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise, let us flee, or else there'll be no escape for us from Absalom. Go in haste, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down evil upon us and smite the city with the edge of the sword." And away they went. But he left behind in Jerusalem a couple of spies, three in fact. The main one was a man called Hushai, who was one of his chief advisers. And he left Hushai back there so that Hushai could pretend to be on Absalom's side, and he could find out what Absalom was up to, and then he could relay news back to David by way of two of the sons of the priests. So he had a spy ring, you might say, right there in the middle of Absalom's court. Absalom, meanwhile, came to Jerusalem and declared himself king, and David was on the run. When you come over to chapter 16, you find that the chief man, the brains behind Absalom's rebellion, was a man called Ahithophel. Ahithophel had told Absalom that if he wanted the rebellion to be a success, he had to make sure that he got rid of David. Ahithophel knew that blood is thicker than water, and there was always the possibility that somehow David and Absalom may be reconciled and a compromise worked out. And of course, if that happened, well, the first person to get the chop would be Ahithophel, who had organized the rebellion. So Ahithophel told Absalom to do what he thought was the worst thing he could do to demonstrate how much he despised his father and how impossible it was for there to be any reconciliation. In verse 20 of chapter 16, Absalom said to Ahithophel, "Give your counsel, what shall we do?" And Ahithophel said, "Go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house." I mentioned last week of the number of illustrations we have where the sign that a man had inherited the kingdom was that he inherited the harem, the royal harem. That was the status symbol of the king, to own the harem. And when the person claimed the harem for himself, he was claiming the throne. So he said, "Here, claim your father's concubines, but do it in a particularly odious fashion. All Israel will hear that you have made yourself odious to your father, and the hands of all who are with you will be strengthened." So they pitched a tent for Absalom upon the roof, and Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. We find in verse 23 that the advice of Ahithophel in those days was considered to be the best available. Moreover, in chapter 17, verse 1, Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Now, from here on, what you do is this. You go and kill David. That's all you need to do. Kill one man, and the whole kingdom is yours. It's not a fight between two armies. as long as you remove the king, the throne is yours. And that was very sensible advice. It avoided bloodshed, it avoided a prolonged war, it was a shortcut to the top. So in chapter 17, verse 1, Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Give me so many thousand soldiers, and I'll set out and pursue David tonight. Verse 2, I'll come upon him while he's weary and discouraged, and throw him into a panic, and all the people who are with me will flee, and I'll strike down the king only, and I'll bring back all the people to you as a bride comes home to her husband. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will then be at peace." Hushai, the other man, the spy left behind, Hushai realized this was very good advice, and he had to beat it somehow. And as we saw earlier, one of the best ways of getting a person onto your side is to appeal to his pride and vanity. And Absalom had pride and vanity in large proportions. So Hushai came to Absalom, and he said in verse 11, "Now this is my counsel. All Israel gather together to you, a general mobilization from Dan to Beersheba, from north to south, so that it will be like the sand of the sea for multitude. Get them all here, a great big army, and then you go out to battle in person, the big wheel in front of them all, resplendent in your armor and going out to do battle." And then he says, "We'll come upon him in some place where he is to be found," and he goes on to say how that he would destroy them. And that appealed to Absalom, because he was an ambitious, proud and vain person, and he accepted the advice of Hushai. And of course that played right into David's hands, and Ahithophel realized that once Absalom had accepted Hushai's advice, that all was lost. He saw that Absalom now had committed himself to failure. And in verse 23, when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he settled his house, went off home to his own city, set his house in order, and hanged himself. He got in first because he knew that Absalom was doomed to defeat now, and once Absalom was defeated, Ahithophel would have been executed anyway. And of course it worked as far as David was concerned, because as you read on the remaining few verses of chapter 17, it gave David just the time he needed. To mobilize all the forces of Israel from north to south took quite some time. That gave David the chance in verse 24 to escape over the Jordan River, and in verse 25 to reassemble his army officers. In verse 27, 28, 29, it gave him time to get provisions of wheat and barley and meal and parched grain and all sorts of things, honey and curds and sheep. He got all these things. In chapter 18, verse 1, after resting his men in the final part of chapter 17, he then mustered his men and he organized them properly. He got commanders of thousands and hundreds, and in verse 2, he divided his army into three parts so that they could properly handle the attack. David now had won the time that he was looking for, and so he was able to organize his own defense. And as you read on, you find that Absalom, of course, was defeated. David had with him all those hardened generals from way back when he was running away from Saul. They'd been with him for many years now, and these chaps were hard-bitten fighters, and they knew what it was like to have guerrilla warfare and to fight in the jungle or in the forests where there are plenty of trees, and they were able to steer David through. Absalom, of course, he had plenty of ambition, plenty of confidence in himself, but the men he got around him, they just were no match for David's very experienced leaders, and the result was that Absalom's crowd were defeated, and Absalom himself was slain. Now once again, David had said, "Don't kill Absalom." A little bit of the old blood is thicker than water there. But Joab had the same realization as Ahithophel had. He said, "Kill Absalom, and the whole thing is over, because it's only a rebellion of one man against another. And if you kill Absalom, the rebellion will collapse on the spot, there'll be no widespread bloodshed, and the reconciliation of the people will take effect more or less immediately." And Joab was the one that made sure he got rid of Absalom, even though he earned David's wrath for doing so. Could we go now, please, to Psalm 3? Through all this, I think David has acted commendably. I don't see anything that he has done which you could say is blameworthy. He is acting in much the same way as he acted when he was fleeing from Saul. He was simply trying to preserve his own life, to save his throne. He himself was not the attacker. and he took all means to avoid unnecessary bloodshed. Psalm 3, we are told, is a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son. Psalm 4 has no title to it apart from the fact that it was written by David, but it seems that it belongs to the same period, and those who put the psalms together had this habit of putting psalms together in groups which belong to the same era. Psalm 3 appears to have been a morning psalm and Psalm 4 an evening psalm. We can picture David as he gets up one morning here in Psalm 3. He realizes that Absalom's rebellion has apparently been successful. Well, in the eyes of the public, it has been anyway. So much so that many thought David had no chance of escaping alive. Oh Lord, he says, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of me, there's no help for him in God. He's had it. David is done for. But verse 3, David's faith in God is unshakable as usual. Thou, O Lord, art a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cry aloud to the Lord, and he answers me from his holy hill. I might be hiding down the Jordan Valley somewhere, but I still cry to the Lord, and he who dwells on Zion hears me. And therefore, he says in verse 5, I can lie down and sleep. I can go to bed at night, he says. Well, his bed may not have been much better than a soft piece of grass or something under a shady tree, but he says, I can lay down at night and go to sleep knowing that God will protect me. And I can wake again, he says, in the morning with renewed confidence, for the Lord sustains me. Therefore, he says in verse 6, I am not afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. Absalom and all his hordes can be tracking me down here, but I can go to sleep in this calm confidence that I am in the right and that God is preserving and protecting me. This is a great place to have, and it's great for us to wake up in the morning with those sorts of confident feelings to face the day. But let us realize that confident feelings, pious feelings, never help us to avoid the situations. The unpleasant confrontation still has to take place. Our devotions do not excuse us from the harsh realities of life, but they may give us the strength to face them. And that's what happened here with David. He still had to face the onslaught of Absalom. Therefore, in confidence, in verse 7, he says, Arise, O Lord, deliver me, O my God, for thou dost smite all my enemies on the cheek. Thou dost break the teeth of the wicked. Deliverance belongs to the Lord. Thy blessing be upon thy people. And with that, he girds up his sword, and off he goes on his day's adventures, seeking to protect himself from the marauding hordes of his rebellious son Absalom. And through the day, we have the sorts of conflicts that we read about in Samuel, how it says we'll come upon him when he's resting at night, and the light upon him is the dew from heaven lights upon somebody, and there's no way that he'll escape. All the advice that was being given out by Absalom's leaders. And so the day goes on, and there's conflict, hide and seek, running away, seeking protection and deliverance. And in the evening, David comes exhausted and lies down again under another tree in some other little shady dell, ready to call it quits for the night. Before he goes to sleep, he prays this prayer, I believe. Answer me when I call, O God of my right. He realizes he's in the right. He has done no wrong, and he is simply out to defend himself and his throne. And he thinks back during the day when he was cornered, but he knows that God delivered him. Thou hast given me room when I was in distress. He thinks of some incident during the day when he was in distress, when it looked as if he was cornered and done for, but yet God gave him room, God gave him deliverance. Be gracious to me, O Lord, he says, and hear my prayer. And then in verse 2, he turns and addresses, in his own mind, his accusers, his enemies, and he accuses them of disloyalty, of self-seeking, of too easily believing the lies, the deceit of Absalom, of too easily being tricked into joining the rebellion. And he says to them in verse 2, O men, How long shall my honor suffer shame? How long are you going to treat me to this enormous disgrace that you heaped upon me? How long will you love vain words and seek after lies? But know this, he says in verse 3, the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. He assures them that they will be defeated, for God is on the side of the righteous. God is on the side of David. God has set apart the godly for himself, and the Lord hears when I call to him. And he encourages himself with that truth. Then in verses 4 and 5, it appears that he turns and in effect addresses his own men, his own supporters. And he gives them this very calm advice, that they must not have thoughts of hatred or revenge, but rather, whatever they do, they must be truly God-centered. He says to them, yes, you can be angry, but don't sin. They had a right to be angry, righteous anger, because of this man who had overthrown the throne of the Lord's anointed. But he says, sin not. Vengeance belongs to me. I will repay, says the Lord. And in the New Testament, you get a similar teaching. Be angry, but don't let the sun go down upon your wrath. There are causes for us to be angry, but those causes must never be excuses for us to go beyond the limits which God has set. Be angry, but sin not. He recommends that they commune with their own hearts on their beds and be silent. There's a great virtue at times in keeping your mouth closed, is what he says. Realize that God is the vindicator of the righteous, and let him be your defense. Offer right sacrifices, verse 5, and put your trust in the Lord. This calm counsel he gives his men, to play it cool, and in spite of the indignation they may feel, yet to trust in God. Trust in him, he says. And when you trust in him, that brings greater joy, greater comfort, greater resourcefulness than anything else. He talks about people who may ask God to bless them. Oh God, bless me in giving me large fields. Bless me in filling my barns with grain. Bless me by giving me great vintage from my harvest of grapes. And he says they can have all that. But even though I'm out here lying under a tree and on the run, yet he says in verse 7, you put more joy in my heart than when they have their grain and when their wine abounds. Yes, in verse 6, those are the people who said, oh, that we might see some good. Lift up the light of thy countenance upon us, O Lord. Bless us and give us all the good things. But David says in verse 7, he has more joy than all these people in spite of the abundance of their blessings. And through all these experiences, David is learning and he's benefiting. He certainly brought some troubles upon himself because of his sin with Bathsheba, and his own household was rent by murder, treachery, immorality. We saw it in Amnon, we saw it in Absalom, all the fruits of the seeds which he had sown. But yet he's a humble man and he's a contrite man, as we know from Psalm 51, and he accepts the chastisement of the Lord and he seeks to live in righteousness. And it's his confidence in God which keeps him afloat. And at the end of the day, as he's had this reflection on his experiences with God through the day, he knows that God has nevertheless, in spite of the tremendous conflicts, put joy in his heart, and therefore he can pull up his sheep rug, he can turn over on his pillow of rock or whatever he had, and go to sleep. Verse 8, in peace, I can now both lie down and sleep, for thou alone, O Lord, makest me dwell in safety.